ॐ गिनजमिनन्दस्याभिगुणजनसलकय चक्षुस्मिलचान्देन तस्मै श्रीगुरुदे नमः श्रीचैतन्यमनुभिस्तां स्तपितां जेन भूतले सायं उपगतमयं गतति स्वपं गतिकाम् वंशकपशुभिश्च कृपसिन्धुभैव च पतितनं पवनेभ्यो वैष्णवेभ्यो नमो नमः Prithu Maharaj replied to the Lord's having asked him, having preached him, and then due to Vishnu's pleasure, or Vishnu's pleasure, he said to Prithu Maharaj, whatever benediction you want. So, quite interesting, the words of Prithu Maharaj. He did not want any karma, did not want the results that would allow him to enjoy any heavenly delight. In the material world, one enjoys according to the subtleness of his senses, and really that's based on the subtleness of his consciousness. So a very gross materialist will engage in gross pleasures, like animalistic pleasures. And there is some enjoyment, and one can say that he's enjoying as much as anyone else, but it is truly universally acknowledged that the more subtle one's enjoyments are, the more enjoyment is present in that. For instance, the subtle enjoyment of very, very fine food would be greater, of gourmet food. A person who tastes gourmet food and relishes those subtle tastes, he enjoys more than the person who just likes to shovel it down the gullet and just puts in tons of something or another, of something very gross. Or the person who just likes the music as loud as possible, with the bass as high as possible. He cannot enjoy like the person who relishes the subtle and intricate melodies of a classical symphony. Everyone knows this. So this tells us that the more subtle one's consciousness is, the more one can enjoy. And that subtleness of consciousness that gives the most subtle, fine, wonderful enjoyment is available only on the heavenly planets or the higher planets. But Prithu Maharaj wasn't interested in any pleasure offered within this material world from gross to subtle, nor any position in the material world up to the highest position. These weren't the benedictions that he asked for, nor was he interested in the fruit of jnana, mukti, liberation, losing all material misery. Not even the slightest touch of material misery. Not interested in that. What was he interested in? He wanted thousands and millions of years. It was funny because Lord Indra was right there. Lord Indra had hundreds and hundreds. His body was covered with eyes. But he wanted ears, not eyes. And why did he want ears and tongues, really, so he could chant and hear the glories of the Lord in the association of pure devotees. In the association of pure devotees. Satam prasangam mam viri samvido bhavanti vitkana rasayana bhava kata. How this is, it brings one to life. Rasayana is the medicine that brings one to life. It is the tonic. Bhavo shada shuktamana brahman, and it brings great transcendental, the most subtle of all pleasure, happiness, to the heart, the ear, the mind. This is what he wanted. And then he went on to describe what he wanted, and he wanted service, because when one hears in the association of pure devotees, one gets the experience of Krishna. And then, with that experience, he wants to serve Krishna. He wants to serve Krishna. So Prithu Maharaj, he expressed in almost a funny way his fear that his desire to serve would cause him to argue and fight, quarrel with Lakshmi Devi, the goddess of fortune, who is the ultimate possessor of wealth, because she is the distributor of wealth within this world. She is born from the ocean of nectar at the time of the churning of the ocean of milk. She is born from the ocean of milk, rather, prior to the nectar issuing. So she is the bestower of all good fortune in this world. So what does she do? She worships, serves the lotus feet of the Lord, and she does such a complete job of serving the lotus feet of the Lord. Prithu is afraid that his desire to serve those lotus feet would cause some jealousy to appear in the heart of Lakshmi Devi. And therefore, he said that, please Lord, don't worry about her being upset. Even if she gets upset with me, you take my side. And if she gets upset with you, don't worry, because you're self-sufficient and you can even do without her. So, somewhat joking, he was speaking like that, but expressing through those words, he was expressing his desire to serve the lotus feet of the Lord, to become situated as a servant. This is what the devotees desire. And they are so attached to the Lord and His service. This is called the sakti. They're so attached. They just want to serve His feet. Ayi Nanda Tanujakinkaram, all son of Nanda Maharaj. Nanda Tanuja, that's Krishna, the son of Nanda. Kinkaram, I am your servant. I am just your servant. So, after saying that, Prithu Maharaj said even the great souls, the great devotees, they also serve the Lord. For what purpose? The ones who are even liberated, they still continue serving the Lord after liberation. They are not like the possessors of Sayuja Mukti, of liberation, where one becomes one with everything. No, even after liberation, they still serve the lotus feet of the Lord to keep them free from material contamination. They are karma sannyasis. They give up all fruit of work. But yet still they need to be free from the types, from contaminations. So they worship the lotus feet of the Lord. And then finally, Prithu Maharaj told the Lord that he didn't, like a father, you please give me what you want. I just want to serve you, and if you want to bestow on me something, what is good for me, you do it. What do I know about what's good for me? You please put me in the position that's best for me. And this is actually the prayer of a devotee. He doesn't say, in my next life, I pray to you that I should do this or that. He puts himself in Krishna's hands and remembers Krishna in his specific mood with great love. So, the Lord previously said, because I'm so pleased with you, you will get something. And what you will get is some wonderful association, because that is the marking of the Lord's mercy upon someone, when he awards very, very good association. So that will come a little later on in the pastime, in chapter 22, when Sanat Kumar preaches to Prithu Maharaj. miss that. So after all this was done, pretty much finished, then in text 32, this is what we hear. Great sage Maitreya continued. Who was he speaking to? Vidura. Thank you. He continued by saying that the Lord, the seer of the universe, after hearing Prita Maharaja's prayer, addressed the king. Here's the Lord's reply. My dear king, may you always be blessed by engaging in my devotional service. Tam aha rajan mayi bhaktirastite. What a wonderful blessing. Only by such purity of purpose as you yourself very intelligently express can one cross over the insurmountable illusory energy of Maya. Purity of purpose, that means one-pointed bhakti, kevala bhakti, one-pointed fixed bhakti. I only want one thing, your service. Not bahushaka tanantascha, but vyavya satmika buddhi, fixed, one-pointed devotion. And one needs great purity for that. So only by such purity, so we should know this. We can say, well, it's so hard to be so pure, and I'm not that pure, and maybe it's a fact, but that's actually the price to cross over the insurmountable ocean of the illusory energy of Maya. Here's Prabhupada's purport. This is confirmed in Bhagavad Gita, wherein the Lord also claims that the illusory energy is insurmountable. No one can transcend the illusory energy of Maya by fruit of activity, speculative philosophy, or mystic yoga. The only means for transcending illusory energy is devotional service, as the Lord Himself states, Mameva ye prapadyante mayam etam tarantite. Bhagavad Gita 7, chapter 14, verse. If one wants to cross over the ocean of material existence, there is no alternative than to take to devotional service. The beginning of that is Daiviyesha Gunamayi. This material energy, why is it so insurmountable? Because it is empowered by the Lord's own energy, and He makes it insurmountable. Daivi, divine, divinely empowered Maya, Gunamayi, Mama Maya Dratya, very difficult to cross over. But one who surrenders unto me, Mameva Te Papadyante Mayama Etantarantite, he can cross over. By grace. So how does one get divine grace? One tries his best. One will never feel, oh, now I'm pure. Now I've given up all material desires. One will never feel like that. Because we even see this exhibited by the great devotees, the most pure, exalted devotees. They are so humble, thinking themselves the most fallen and least qualified and most contaminated. They are so painfully aware of any subtle little thing in their consciousness, and they feel themselves not possessing even the fragrance, the distant fragrance of love for Krishna. Once Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, someone said, you love Krishna? And his reply was, if I love Krishna, how would I still be alive? Like Dasarath, the father of Ram, when Ram left, Dasarath died. A separation of a broken heart. So it is not that one will ever feel himself, oh, now I'm pure. We can forget about that. Oh, now I'm pure. My work is done. My purifying work is done. No. Rather, we can expect feeling more and more impure. And the pride will go. The humility will be there. And then, by the virtue of that attempt the humility plus the attempt to please Krishna, by the virtue of that, then Krishna and the devotees, Krishna and Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and the devotees, they will be merciful and they will make up Krishna promises in the Bhagavad Gita. I will give you what you don't have and maintain what you do have. So Krishna's divine grace is there. Our business is to try very, very hard, sincerely. So a devotee, therefore, should not care for any material position, whether in heaven or hell. A pure devotee should always engage in the service of the Lord, for that is his real occupation. Simply by sticking to that position, one can overcome the stringent laws of material nature. I'm a servant. And what does a servant do? He serves. That is my nature. That is my position. There's a Bengali saying that, I don't know the Bengali, but what is it about the deki? You know what it is? That there's a little simple machine used for, not a really a machine, it's like a piece of wood that, and something, and it crushes spices. And the people, the ladies, they're holding that baby or something, they'll stand on one end and they'll pick up that foot, and then there's weight and it goes down and it'll crush the spices again and again. So whether in heaven or hell, the deki does the same thing. Do you know the Bengali expression? So we are servants. Like the deki, it does one thing. So we are servants. So that's the devotee's mood. I may have so many impurities, but yet I'm a servant of Krishna. I've acknowledged, accepted that. So let me serve to the best of my capacity, praying always to Krishna to help me in his service, because I have no ability to succeed on my own. So that really takes sincerity and humility. So the Lord acknowledged Prita Maharaja's purity and blessed him that he may always engage in devotional service. My dear king, he said, O protector of the citizens, henceforward be very careful to execute my orders and not be misled by anything. Anyone who lives in that way, simply carrying out my orders faithfully, will always find good fortune all over the world. So acting solely for Krishna's pleasure, based on his order, as this verse explains, this is the essence of religion. And such a person will shobha. It's auspicious. Wherever he will, everything auspicious will happen to him, and wherever he goes, he will spread auspiciousness. Then Maitreya continues to tell Vidura in text 34. The Supreme Personality of Godhead amply appreciated the meaningful prayers of Maharaj Prithu. Thus, after being properly worshipped by the king, so the king worshipped him, the Lord blessed him and decided to depart. Read a little of Prabhupada's purport. Most important in this verse are the words Vatinadhyartavadvacha, which indicate that the Lord appreciated the very meaningful prayers of the king. When a devotee prays to the Lord, it is not to ask for material benefits, but to ask the Lord for his favor. He prays that he may be engaged in the service of the Lord's lotus feet, birth after birth. Lord Chaitanya therefore uses the words mama janamani janamani, which means birth after birth, because a devotee is not even interested in stopping the repetition of birth. So the Lord appreciated the prayers, and then he prepared to leave. Then, as he was leaving, the Lord, or Prithu Maharaj, worshipped him. And also because everyone was there in the sacrifice, because this took place after the 99th sacrifice, and Indra was there. So then Prithu Maharaj worshipped the Lord. He worshipped the demigods who were present. He worshipped everyone who was present, all the sages who were present, and he offered them gifts, wealth, and sweet words. And then everyone, including the Lord, left, and the king returned to his home. So that ends chapter 20, and we'll go on to chapter 21. So the king entered his capital city. What did he see? What was his capital city like as the result of his pure consciousness, his pure Krishna consciousness? This is the description. When the king entered his city, it was very beautifully decorated to receive him with pearls. These were the decorations. Pearls, flower garlands, beautiful cloth, and golden gates. And the entire city was perfumed with highly fragrant incense. Now when they want to decorate, and when some heroes or someone comes home and they want to give him a hero's welcome, what do? They parade them through the streets, and in New York what they do, they throw shredded paper on them. Or, if there's no shredded paper, garbage out the window, or something at least you have to throw. Beautiful cloth, golden gates, perfumed with highly fragrant incense. And these things, it's quite incredible. When there's you see this in the anywhere where the devotees know the method, when they use auspicious decorations, they use banana leaves and incense and coconuts and this and that, and a sacrificial fire, the atmosphere becomes very, very, very auspicious, subtle, happy, spiritual. You can feel it. It's very, very obvious. So how wonderful. Prabhupada's purport. Real opulence is supplied by natural gifts such as gold, silver, pearls, valuable stones, fresh flowers, trees, and silken cloth. Thus the Vedic civilization recommends opulence and decoration with these natural gifts of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Such opulence immediately changes the condition of the mind. That's what I meant. The auspiciousness comes to the mind. The mind changes. And the entire atmosphere becomes spiritualized, and the chanting of Vedic mantras. King Preetor's capital was decorated with such highly opulent decorations. Fragrant water distilled from sandalwood and agarwar was sprinkled everywhere on the lanes, roads, and small parks throughout the city. And everywhere were decorations of unbroken fruit, flowers, wetted grains, varied minerals, and lamps, all presented as auspicious paraphernalia. At the street crossings, there were bunches of fruits and flowers, as well as pillars of banana trees and betel nut branches. All these combined decorations everywhere look very attractive. So it does something to the atmosphere. As the king entered the city of the gate of the city, all the citizens received him with many auspicious articles like lamps, flowers, and yogurt. The king was also received by many beautiful unmarried girls whose bodies were bedecked with various ornaments, especially with earrings which collided with one another. Srila Prabhupada's purport. Offerings of natural products such as betel nut, nuts, bananas, newly grown wheat, paddy, yogurt, vermilion, carried by the citizens and scattered throughout the city, are all auspicious paraphernalia according to Vedic civilization. For receiving a prominent guest like a bridegroom, king, or spiritual master, this is what's done. Similarly, a welcome offered by unmarried girls who are internally and externally clean and are dressed in nice garments and ornaments is also auspicious. Kumari, or unmarried girls untouched by the hand of any member of the opposite sex, are auspicious members of society. Even today in Hindu society, The most conservative families do not allow unmarried girls to go out freely or mix with boys. They are very carefully protected by their parents while unmarried. After marriage, they are protected by their young husbands, and when elderly, they are protected by their children. When thus protected, women as a class remain an always auspicious source of energy to man. So the Kumaris were there too. Text 5. When the king entered the palace, conch shells and kettle drums were sounded, priests chanted Vedic mantras, and professional reciters offered different prayers. But in spite of all this ceremony to receive him, to welcome him, the king was not the least bit affected. In other words, he wasn't proud. He didn't think, oh, this is the most wonderful thing. The atmosphere was wonderful and they were doing their duty. But there was no pride on his part, thinking they are doing this for me. Here is Prabhupada's sweet little purport, short purport. The reception given to the king was full of opulence. Yet he did not become proud. It was all meant for him, but he didn't become proud. It is said, therefore, that great personalities of power and opulence never become proud. And the example is given that a tree, which is full of fruits and flowers, does not stand erect in pride, but instead bends downward to show submissiveness. This is a sign of the wonderful character of great personalities. Both the important citizens, as text 6, and the common citizens welcomed the king very heartily. And he also bestowed upon them their desired blessings. Prabhupada's purport. A responsible king was always approachable by his citizens. Generally, the citizens, great and common, all had an aspiration to see the king and take benediction from him. The king knew this. So it's like when if there's a when a big, powerful person comes, or someone who's very famous, naturally, there's an inclination to want to meet him. And when the person is very, very powerful and wealthy and opulent, naturally one wants to ask him for something. So when the king, the Vedic system was that the king was actually approachable by the citizens. And even in modern times, or more or less modern times, the citizens would be able to approach the king when they were kings. They had their time to come and register their complaints. And he would, just like in the Bible, there's that story of King Solomon. I guess that's not modern times. But the with King Solomon, there were two ladies who said that this child, they were arguing over one child. One said it was the child is mine, and the other one said, no, the child is mine. So the king was so wise that he said, okay, you're saying the child is yours? And you're saying the child is yours, so what should we do? We should cut the child in half. And you can have half, and you can have half. And one of the ladies said, okay, let's do it. And the other lady said, no, I couldn't tolerate that. And you take the child. So he said, okay, you must be the real mother. And he gave it to him. He understood. He tested the mind. So in that way, what that means is they had the opportunity to bring their problems and disputes to the king, and he was so wise and powerful, he would immediately settle it. So everyone wanted to go before the king, and the king knew this. And therefore, whenever he met the citizens, he immediately fulfilled their desires or mitigated their grievances. And also in India, when you meet, when there's a big person, a powerful leader, if you meet him, he always has a personal assistant with him, and anything he wants to do later that comes up or remember, he tells the personal assistant who writes it down. So if he's walking from one place to another and you see him, you say, I have this problem, blah, 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 and he'll say, okay, I'll fix it. And he tells his personal assistant to write it down, and he does it. So in this way, the citizens feel so grateful and protected that this person actually cares about me. And I have someone to go to if I have a problem on the governmental level. So he immediately fulfilled their desires or mitigated their grievances. In such dealings, a responsible monarch is better than a so-called democratic government in which no one is responsible to mitigate the grievances of the citizens who are unable to personally meet the supreme executive head. In a responsible monarchy, the citizens had no grievances against the government, and even if they did, they could approach the king directly for immediate satisfaction. So it sounds very wonderful. King Prithu was greater than the greatest soul and was therefore worshipable by everyone. He performed many glorious activities in ruling over the surface of the world and was always magnanimous. After achieving such great success and a reputation which spread throughout the universe, he at last obtained the lotus feet of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. We'll read some of this purport. A responsible king or executive has many responsible duties to attend to in ruling over the citizens. The most important duty of the monarch or the government is to perform various sacrifices as enjoined in the Vedic literatures. The next duty of the king is to see that every citizen executes the prescribed duties for his particular community. So the first duty is to make sure the sacrifices are performed so that the kingdom remains opulent and full of enough piety that everyone will be satisfied. Second duty, because the Lord is satisfied by opulence. Second duty, to make sure that the citizens are all performing their prescribed duties. This is his prescribed duty, to make sure everyone is doing their prescribed duties. So it is the king's duty to see that everyone perfectly executes the duties prescribed for the Vana and Ashrama divisions of society. And beside that, as exemplified by King Prithu, he must develop the earth for the greatest possible production of food grains. Three main duties there. There are different types of great personalities. Some are positive great personalities. That means they are good. Some comparative. They are better. And some superlative. They are best. But King Prithu exceeded all of them, better than the best. He therefore is described here as Mahattama, greater than the greatest. Suta Goswami continues. So Suta Goswami was narrating to the rishis of Namasharanya, headed by Shonaka, that which Sukadev Goswami was narrating to Prikit Maharaj, and he was narrating that which Vidura was hearing from Maitreya Muni. So Sutta said, "O Shonaka, leader of the great sages, after hearing Maitreya speak about the various activities of King Prithu, the original king, who is fully qualified, glorified, and widely praised all over the world, Vidura, the great devotee, submissively worshipped Maitreya Muni and asked him the following question. Vidura said, "My dear Brahmana Maitreya, it is very enlightening to understand that King Prithu was enthroned by the great sages and Brahmanas." Haribol, just returned or? Oh, how nice. "To understand that King Prithu was enthroned by the great sages and Brahmins. All the demigods presented him with innumerable gifts, and he also expanded his influence upon personally receiving strength from Lord Vishnu. Thus he greatly developed the earth." Another purport. We can see how amazing a true king was, and so far from the current government and the governmental systems. Because Prithu Maharaj, as Prabhupada's purport, was an empowered incarnation of Lord Vishnu and was naturally a great Vaishnava devotee of the Lord, all the demigods were pleased with him and presented different gifts to help him in exercising his royal power. And the great sages and saintly persons also joined in his coronation. Thus blessed by them, he ruled over the earth and exploited its resources for the greatest satisfaction of the people in general. This has already been explained in the previous chapters regarding the activities of King Prithu. As will be apparent from the next verse, every executive head of state should follow in the footsteps of Prithu Maharaj in ruling over the kingdom. Regardless of whether the chief executive is a king or president, or whether the government is monarchical or democratic, this process is so perfect that if it is followed, everyone will become happy. And thus it will be very easy for all to execute devotional service to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So there Prabhupada is saying directly that regardless of what type of governmental system is in place, monarchy, republican system, this system, democratic system, whatever it is, communist system, whatever. But if these principles are followed, the principles that Maharaj Prithu governed by, then people will actually be happy and the government will be successful. Because everyone will be able to execute devotional service. Text 10. Prithu Maharaj was so great in his activities and magnanimous in his method of ruling that all the kings and demigods on the various planets will still follow in his footsteps. Who is there who will not try to hear about his glorious activities? So Bhadura is saying, I wish to hear more and more about Prithu Maharaj because his activities are so pious and auspicious. Again, Prabhupada's purport. Saint Vidura's purpose in hearing about Prithu Maharaj over and over again was to set an example for ordinary kings and executive heads who should all be inclined to hear repeatedly about Prithu Maharaj's activities in order to also be able to rule over their kingdoms or states very faithfully for the peace and prosperity of the people in general. Unfortunately, at the present moment, no one cares to hear about Prithu Maharaj or to follow in his footsteps. Therefore, no nation in the world is either happy or progressive in spiritual understanding, although that is the sole aim and objective of human life. My dear Vidura, Maitreya said, King Prithu lived in the tract of land between the two great rivers, Ganges and Jamuna. Because he was very opulent, it appeared that he was enjoying his destined fortune in order to diminish the results of his past pious activities. It appeared as if he was just getting the results of his pious activities. But Prabhupada explains in the purport that wasn't at all the case. Actually, he was the Lord. He was an empowered incarnation of the Lord. And therefore, there was no karma for him. It was just Krishna acting through him. And secondarily, he was a great devotee, and the devotees don't have any karma. That's what Prabhupada explains. There are no reactions resulting from past deeds. For a pure devotee, there is just Krishna's mercy. Prithu Maharaj was an unrivaled king and possessed the scepter for ruling all the seven islands on the surface of the globe. No one could disobey his irrevocable order. But the saintly persons, the Brahmins, and the descendants of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the Vaishnavas, Achyuta Gosha. So everyone was bound by his order. No one could disobey it. No one had the power to disobey that order. Except, there's exceptions, the devotees, the Brahmins, the sages, like that. In other words, those saintly persons were free. They didn't have to follow the governmental laws as the ordinary citizens did. But that doesn't mean that they flaunted them, they went against them. The reason why they didn't have to follow is that naturally they did the right thing, because they were saintly. They were pure, they were good, they were Vaishnavas, they were serving Krishna. So naturally they did the right thing. But if somehow or another they went against the law, there was no punishment for them because it was understood that the case was exceptional and that other, the ordinary common people who were under the dictates of the lower modes, they would not follow this example. 13. Now we're moving towards the next pastime. Once upon a time, Ekadasim, that's Ekada, means one day, once upon a time, or once, King Prithu initiated the performance of a very great sacrifice, in which great saintly sages, brahmanas, demigods from higher planetary systems, and great saintly kings known as Rajarishis all assembled. In that great assembly, Prithu Maharaj first of all worshipped all the respectable visitors according to their respective positions. After this, he stood up in the midst of the assembly, and it appeared that the full moon had arisen amongst the stars. King Prithu's body was tall and sturdy, and his complexion was fair. His arms were full and broad, and his eyes were as bright as the rising sun. What color is the rising sun? Green? No. It's reddish, but it's bright. I just read how Krishna's eyes, this morning I was reading something, there was a verse from the Bhagavatam that described how Krishna's eyes are reddish like the rising sun. But it meant they were reddish. Yes, reddish like the rising sun in the morning. It was actually when Uddhava sees the Lord, just before the Lord departs from this world, when he leaves, Uddhava sees him sitting under an asat tree, a banyan tree, and the Lord is sitting there very, very, very beautifully. And even though he's about to leave this world, and even though the Yadu dynasty has just all killed each other, and even though Balaram has sat down by the ocean, and he's left this world in meditation, and Krishna is just sitting there very peacefully, very happy, in a forearm form, looking very cheerful and beautiful in yellow garments. And his eyes were reddish. And Uddhava came and saw him there. Because Uddhava describes how Uddhava knew that Krishna was going to leave the world. So he said, Krishna, please don't let me stay here after you leave. I want to go. I want to go with you. So Krishna said, no, you can't. Because I have a mission for you. I have something that I want you to do. He explained that although I have done so many things during my pastimes in this world, I've instructed so many people, there is one last part of my mission that I have so far yet failed to do. I wish that the sages in Badrikashram get my association and take some instruction. But I am leaving this world now, so Uddhava, I want you to do this. So you can't depart now. You go to Badrikashram. So Krishna then instructed him. And the instructions that he gave are the most part of the 11th canto called the Uddhava Gita. There's the Bhagavad Gita and then there's the Uddhava Gita. The instructions the Lord sung sweetly to Uddhava. So after receiving these instructions, Krishna told Uddhava, okay, now you go to Badrikashram. So Uddhava, of course, didn't want to go, but the Lord insisted, so he left. And then there were many inauspicious signs in Dwarka. There were omens that there was going to be a disaster. So Krishna called all the members of the Yadu dynasty and said, let's see all this. We should go to Prabhachetra and perform a sacrifice, something auspicious to remove the inauspiciousness. So everyone went to Prabhachetra in boats. Ladies went somewhere else with the children, and everyone else went in boats to Prabhas. And then when Uddhava heard that Krishna and the devotee and all of his family members had gone to Prabhachetra, left Dwarka, he had already been sent by Krishna, because Krishna didn't want him to see what had happened. He wanted to spare him for what was going to happen, that all the Yadus were going to be killed.
that Uddhava came back. He was going to Badarika Ashram and he stopped his journey and went to see Krishna, drawn, impelled by his loving affection for Krishna. He broke following Krishna's order, going out of full love, and he went to see Krishna at Prabhachacha. And by the time he got there, not a member of the Yadu dynasty was alive. Only Krishna was remaining. And he was sitting under this tree, looking cheerful. And Maitreya Muni then came, and Maitreya Muni heard Krishna instructing Uddhava some last instructions, and then Maitreya Muni is the one, because he heard that, Vidura is hearing from Maitreya, and that's what we're hearing now. Maitreya Muni, who heard at that time, he's instructing Vidura. So this is the beautiful body of the Lord. His body, Prithu Maharaj's body, was tall and sturdy, a Kshatriya's body. And his complexion was fair, his arms were full and broad, and his eyes as bright as the rising sun. His nose was straight, his face very beautiful, and his personality grave. Grave means deep, that one cannot fathom, understand the depths of his thinking. His teeth were set beautifully in his smiling face. The chest of Maharaj Prithu was very broad, his waist was thick, and his abdomen wrinkled by lines of skin resembling in construction a leaf of a banyan tree. His navel was coiled and deep, his thighs were of a golden hue, and his instep was arched. The black slick hair in his head was very fine and curly, and his neck like a conch shell was decorated with auspicious lions. Wrapper on the upper portion of his body was a nice wrapper on the upper part of his body. It was placed, the Sanskrit is upaviya. It was placed like a sacred thread. In other words, there are different ways. He was wearing a chadar, a wrapper, and it was placed in this style, like this, like the sacred thread, as opposed to that style wrapped around the shoulders. This is more, I think, South Indian style, yeah. In the Bengalis, at least the Brahmacharis. His teeth were set beautifully in his smiling face. His instep was arched. Yes. As Maharaj Prithu was being initiated to perform the sacrifice, so even if one is already initiated, when one performs a sacrifice, one gets initiated in a special way to be able to perform that sacrifice. There's a special type of initiation that doesn't contradict the fact that one may already be initiated. So he had to leave aside his valuable dress, and therefore his natural, beautiful, his bodily beauty was visible. It was very pleasing to see him put on a black deerskin. This was the dress that he had to wear during the sacrifice, and wear a ring of kusha grass on his finger. For this increased the natural beauty of his body. It appears that Maharaj Prithu observed all the regulative principles before he performed the sacrifice. Just to encourage the members of the assembly and to enhance their pleasure, King Prithu glanced over them with eyes that seemed like stars in a sky wet with dew. He then spoke to them in a great voice. Maharaj Prithu's speech was very beautiful, full of metaphorical language, clearly understandable, and very pleasing to hear. His words were all grave and certain. It appears that when he spoke, he expressed his personal realization of the Absolute Truth in order to benefit all who were present. So then, for the next 12 or so, maybe 13 slokas, verses, we will hear the words of Prithu Maharaj, even more than that. He's going to instruct his citizens who are all there.
So it's important for us to hear what he instructs them. And also then, following that, in the next chapter, we will hear, as the sacrifice goes on, the four Kumaras come, and we will hear the instructions that he gets from the four Kumaras. Sanat Kumar. Okay, we'll stop here. Thank you very much. Any questions or comments? Yes.
What's the difference between Indra and Prithu Maharaj in regards to Shakti Raj?
Indra is empowered by the Lord to do his service. But he still has material desires. He desires to enjoy, to rule, to be powerful. And therefore, because there are tinges, subtle as they are, for that type of enjoyment, he is still in the material world. He's a Sakam devotee. He can be said to be a Sakam devotee. The devotee with material desires. The spirit of enjoyment, even though he's a devotee, isn't eradicated from his consciousness, so therefore he must stay in the material world. But Prithu Maharaj was a pure devotee. And also a Shakta Vaishavatar. So his ruling and his taking the position of kingship was done simply dutifully, empowered by Krishna, but with no independent desire for enjoyment on his own, for himself. That's my simple understanding. Any other questions or comments?
How can it be nice to them?
How can you what?
How can you recognize our motives? Because sometimes it seems like we're using our abilities in Krishna service.
Yeah. So how do we distinguish?
It comes like we're trying to enjoy you recently. How can you recognize?
So what is the difference? So if then we use our own abilities in Krishna's service, and naturally that will give the living entity pleasure, even if he's pure. That's actually the pleasure for the soul, to use one's individuality in Krishna's service. That is purity. But when one is pure, the interest is Krishna's pleasure. It is solely and only Krishna's pleasure. And when one is impure, one wants his own fame and prestige, etc., to increase. So, and one wants to get something for himself out of doing it. That's the point. And the pure devotee, the only thing he wants is Krishna to be pleased. So your question wasn't what it is, but how to recognize it in ourselves. It's obviously very difficult, because one can't judge oneself very easily. Either one tends to be overly harsh on oneself or overly lenient on oneself, so therefore one should go to a doctor, a teacher, and have him examine us and prescribe for us. Anyone else want to say anything about that one? Anyone have any thoughts on that? Let's just see. Anyone else wants to say anything about that? Yeah?
If we, when we associate with devotees that are more advanced than them, even much more, even after years, the more, the better. And we could tolerate always being in their association.
If it doesn't make us too envious.
Yeah.
So when there's a bright light, the dirt shows up clearly. So when we're in the association of very advanced devotees, we see, practically speaking, that unless we're on the platform of practically bhava, there's going to be some motivation in there. Just before that, sakti, or there'll be something. Some anarthas will be there.
You should be able to clearly recognize that difference in our ability to check that tendency. Whole idea of the issue.
Do you think objecting the tendencies just rest on our ability?
No.
No.
Well,
awareness. But as I said in the beginning, that what we have to look forward to, in my opinion, is just becoming more and more aware of the horrible things in our heart. Not thinking that now they're all objected and now I'm pure. That won't happen, because we see in the example of these, of the lives of the great devotees, when they're advanced, they feel themselves most fallen. So if they're feeling themselves most fallen, that means they're very aware of things in their heart that they don't think are pure. Like when Kaviraj Goswami, Krishna's Kaviraj, says that I'm like a worm in stool. What is that example? It means that stool is obviously a horrible, filthy thing. But when you try to take the worm out, he's holding on, he's attached to it. So Kaviraj Goswami is saying that I'm attached to material things which are horrible. So he's feeling like that, even though he has no material attachments. So what can we say? Maybe there's another angle on this. So good association is very important in this. And to chant nicely with longing, with pretty affection, dutifully serve.
One need to take a very, very, very cavatish.
Well, one may have to take, like Preetam Raj, you couldn't say that he's taking a humble position externally. He's the king. King can't be humble. We saw he was fighting the earth, he was fighting, he was about to kill Indra. But inside he was doing it as a servant, not motivated by false ego. So yes, one has to be a servant, one has to be humble. Not a very pleasing thought to the materialistic mind. Any other questions or comments? We'll stop. So next week, if Krishna allows, we'll continue the instructions by Preetam Raj to the citizens. Prabhupada ki jai, Gaur Bhakti ki jai, Prabhupada ki jai, Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai.